Not the red wave that many predicted. Still, the forecast for Washington politics for the next 2 years remains stormy, with a strong chance of gridlock. We'll break down midterm election results that split control of the U.S. Congress between Democrats and Republicans. Why this outcome, and does it dampen Donald Trump's formal run for re-election announcement that's due next week? More broadly, has his brand of nativist politics hit its glass ceiling? How far will the far right and so-called election deniers now go? On this side of the Atlantic, no one's rooting for turmoil. In the nation that's leading the bankrolling and supply of Ukraine's war effort, what do U.S. midterm results mean for Vladimir Putin, global trade tensions, and UN-led efforts to tackle the planet's climate emergency? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking what did happen to that red wave. Joining us from Memphis, Tennessee, Democratic Congressman Steve Cohen. Congratulations on your re-election. 70% of the vote, I see.
Yes, thank you very much. Gratifying.
From Pittsburgh, former Pennsylvania Republican Congresswoman Melissa Hart is with us. Thank you for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Jeremy Guez, director of French Business School HEC's Center for Geopolitics. How are you, sir?
Great. Thank you for having me.
And Annick Cizel, associate professor of U.S. foreign policy at Paris Sorbonne Nouvelle University. Nice to see you. Thanks for joining us. The France 24 debate, where you can join the conversation you have on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. For those who don't know the intricacies of U.S. politics, midterm elections are all about Congress, but there are also governorships and referendums in states and counties. Before we dive into it, let me just ask you, Steve Cohen, I see that Tennessee's constitution now officially bans all forms of slavery. Wasn't slavery already banned in Tennessee?
Well, the Constitution is very difficult to amend, and there's a process to do it, and there have been conventions in the past, of which I served in the last one in 1977. But it was something that was put in there after the Civil War, and it said slavery was banned, but not for imprisonment for a crime. And that's the way they looked at it back after the Civil War. And nobody, of course, has been enslaved. It was just basically a technicality. But it was removed, and it was, you know, it should have been removed and never had been there. But it's just a technicality from 170 years ago.
20%, I see, of the voters went against it. Who voted against this?
I have no idea, but it's not the most intelligent or the most forward-looking individuals.
One gavel over in Washington seems sure to change hands, and that is that of the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker. Republicans, according to our last count, the Associated Press's last count, lead the Democrats 203 to 187. Let me get your reaction to that, Melissa Hart. We could have, a swing of, perhaps to two dozen seats towards the Republicans. Republicans are going to gain control of the lower house. In the past, we've seen landslides in midterm elections. Not this time. Why?
Yeah, I think this time people are disrupted because of what's going on with the economy. But, you know, it always goes back to, is my congressman doing his or her job? In Pennsylvania, with a wide variety of candidates of all kinds of different stripes, we didn't have seats change party hands. We had our incumbents all retained, whether they were far left or far right. And it seems to me that this was less an election of a wave than it was an election of, you know, if somebody's extremely distasteful, we're going to try to get rid of them. Otherwise, we're keeping who we got. Maybe because we're in the middle of the term, they don't see the change would make much difference in the middle of the president's term. But it was kind of fascinating to see that happen, even with the open seats where they were retained, when it looked like a couple of them might move from Republican or Democrat to Republican. They didn't.
All right. And that's over in the House of Representatives. In the Senate, they're still counting ballots across the country as well. There are three tight races: Arizona, Nevada, those could take days, and Georgia, where, according to U.S. networks, it will now take months. That's because Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker are going to a runoff. The only seat to flip so far from red to blue was in Pennsylvania, in fact. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman winning despite suffering a stroke during the campaign, beating Trump-backed TV personality Dr. Mehmet Oz.
I'm proud of what we ran on. Protecting a woman's right to choose. Raising our minimum wage. Fighting the union way of life. Healthcare is a fundamental human right. It saved my life, and it should all be there for you when you ever should need it.
Melissa Hart, how do you interpret this win by John Fetterman?
Well, I think a lot, too many people are giving John Fetterman a bunch of credit. I don't actually think he's competent to serve in the Senate following his stroke. But, you know, the wave certainly didn't happen here. We had probably the ugliest, most contentious Republican primary for the U.S. Senate that I've ever seen. And the winner of it came out of it very damaged, and that was Mehmet Oz. And I don't think he ever recovered from the damage inflicted in a multi-million dollar negative campaign against him. He barely lost. It looked like the last percentage I saw was just over 50% for Fetterman. And I think he benefited from the destruction done in a Republican primary because he really doesn't offer much.
Steve Cohen, let me just get your reaction on this quickly, because what we're hearing from Melissa Hart is that it's entrenched views that win the day in U.S. politics these days, and nasty fights in the primaries leave scars in the general election. Is that how you see it?
No, I really don't. Most of the seats that I think the Republicans picked up to give them a majority, and we don't know how many seats they picked up and what their level will be. It looks like 5 or 6 votes or so, but it might be, it's just kind of not clear yet, were because of redistricting. After the 2020 census, and we redistrict, we have a census every 10 years, and after that we redistrict, and in Florida, in what was been challenged in court and will be heard in court, there was a redistricting done by Ron DeSantis that made 3 seats clearly Republican seats that otherwise would not have been such. They were previously Democratic seats. And then in Texas, they had 1 seat similar to that. And I'm not saying the Democrats are necessarily without using redistricting to their advantage as well. We tried to do it in New York, and the courts ruled against us, and they changed the districts, and the courts redistricted. But the redistricting had a lot to do with it. Now, the Democrats, only 3 Democratic incumbents lost, and they were 3 outstanding members. Elaine Luria was on the January 6th committee and had spent 20 years in the Navy. Tom Malinowski had been the State Department for about 20 years, and our caucus chairman, Sean Patrick Maloney. These are 3 people who probably was terribly intelligent. I'd say IQ is probably in the 140 area. They worked hard, brought good legislation to the floor, and explained it clearly. So it's a loss that they were defeated. But I think redistricting really hurt Maloney, and it hurt him. Luria got hurt redistricting too. Her seat was made a little bit more Republican. And Malinowski got hurt too in New Jersey. They took care of certain members. They didn't take care of him as well. And they each got a little worse seat because of redistricting. But redistricting has a lot to do with it. And the Florida situation will be heard. And I think the courts will clearly say Florida was unconstitutional because they took away the opportunity for the African-American population to have a person they wanted to elect, a person of their choice. That will, unfortunately, not discard the election this year, but it will change the go back to the legislature to draw new lines for 2024.
And you see, watching this from France, of course, in our country, redistricting is something that's done by the Interior Ministry, by the government, and as is the vote counting. That's why we get the tallies by the next day. In the U.S., it's different. There's a tug of war between the states and the government, and we're also seeing, are you getting this feeling that it's kind of like in 2020 where we had to wait and wait and wait to know the final outcome?
Yeah, it seems it's going to be the case again, especially for the Senate, again, with this Georgia runoff, which is expected now by December 6th, if I'm not mistaken, which means that the results are not just postponed, but I guess redistricting is also making pollsters is also making it harder for pollsters to really envision what is going to happen. It's difficult, more and more difficult to compare what took place in 2020, we are in 2022, what took place in 2020 or 2018 with today. One of the lessons, though, that I'm taking from the early results that we're getting right now is that the Americans, just like the French, may vote for a political party. They may vote for ideas, but they're also voting for human beings. They're also voting for representatives in the generic sense of the term that represent them, whether it is in the House or in the Senate.
It is a personality contest.
It is also a personality contest, and which seems, at least for the early results that I could compute this morning, French time, throughout the day now, seems to have depolarized what was hyped so much in recent weeks. It seems that some races that were hyped by the networks, hyped on the social networks especially so much, the American people, I don't know to what extent I can generalize to every one of the 50 states, but it seems that the American people have voted against this polarization to a certain extent, at least have not followed the hype that was taking place on the social networks around this and that candidate, but voted for the person that they understand, care for, that looks like them, much more than the hype on the networks.
Jeremy Guez?
That's the glass half full. The glass half empty is that today, to me, no one really won those midterms. There's a word of warning to Republicans. This was the midterms for them to lose. And to me, they clearly did not reach their objective. This is not the blowout in the House. By this time today, we're still discussing who's going to win the Senate. And this is basically a major, major loss, because given the very low approval ratings of this president, they should have been able to convert that by historical standards. But I think there's also a word of warning against to Democrats as well, because when you look at what's happening in Florida, when you look at how Governor DeSantis flipped Miami-Dade, one of the most Democratic counties of Florida by any historical measure. I don't know if we know the results in Fort Lauderdale, but it was awfully close. It also means that we not being Trump is not going to be a message that will last forever and one that will be successful forever. Ron DeSantis has an agenda. Not all Americans are going to agree with that agenda, but he has an agenda and he represents something. On the other side, I feel that these Democrats are kind of having a very difficult time thinking about what they stand for and how does that get defined, not as opposed to Trump, but as opposed to something else.
Yeah, what they stand for, we're going to bring up that point. First, though, let's again introduce our viewers with Ron DeSantis, undoubtedly the biggest winner on the night on the Republican side, reelected handily governor of Florida, the state that Donald Trump now calls home. Former president's already started trading barbs with a DeSantis that has an eye to that 2024 presidential race. Antonia Kerrigan has more.
He became governor 4 years ago in a contest so tight it needed a recount. This time round, there was no suspense for Ron DeSantis, as the 44-year-old Republican secured a second mandate with a landslide victory in Florida.
We not only won election, we have rewritten the political map.
The former soldier and father of three has campaigned as an unapologetic culture warrior, laying into what he calls the woke agenda of Democrats.
We fight the woke in the legislature. We fight the woke in the schools. We fight the woke in the corporations. We will never, ever surrender to the woke mob. Florida is where woke goes to die.
From signing a 15-week abortion ban into law earlier this year to leading the conservative backlash to LGBTQ rights, DeSantis' hardline politics are not far from those of Donald Trump, a growing rivalry that has clearly ruffled the feathers of the former president, who fired a warning shot at a rally over the weekend.
We're winning big, big, big in the Republican Party for the nomination like nobody's ever seen before.
Let's see, there it is. Trump at 71. Ron DeSanctimonious at 10%.
DeSantis' resounding re-election has boosted his credentials as a potential candidate in 2024, a possibility that could upend Trump's own plans to find his way back into the White House.
Melissa Hart, who would you like to see run for president for the Republicans in 2024?
Yeah, before I start there, I think another comment on the congressional. I think there was no disagreement there, I think, between the congressman and me regarding the redistricting. I didn't even talk about that. My point, which I think was lost, was that people kind of hewed to something that they were already comfortable with. And you saw it, obviously, in redistricting. Some of those members lost because their districts changed. It wasn't something that was comfortable anymore. When you look at what's coming now, again, we just finished the 2022 cycle. I think that there's a long way to go before either party figures out what they're doing. I doubt that the Democrats want Joe Biden to be the candidate. And I know, as a Republican, that many do not want Donald Trump to be the Republican nominee. At this point in time, there's a lot of great governors, Ron DeSantis certainly among them, because he did have a victory margin of 20 points last night, which is pretty amazing. And it does show that he is a successful leader, already putting in a term after the pluses and minuses of actually serving in office. He was able to win with that large a margin. But, you know, his statewide campaign partner, U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, won with a similar margin. And you may recall that Senator Rubio was one of the candidates for president when Donald Trump ran in that very large primary. So I think the Republicans are going to have a lot of thinking to do. Donald Trump brings some negatives that I think a lot of us are not willing to put up with. And so as we move forward, it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out, because I do believe it's a wide open field right now.
When you talk about negatives, do you mean that the candidate has to tack more to the center?
I think that the candidate actually has to be a polite and good leader, focused on service. And that's not what we see with Mr. Trump. It's more about Mr. Trump. So it's important, I think, for the Republican Party to find someone who is truly a public servant. And I think Ron DeSantis, among others, has demonstrated that. I think someone you're probably quite familiar with, Nikki Haley, has demonstrated that. There's a number of very, I think, highly qualified and very good public servants who will show themselves as candidates, including former Vice President Mike Pence.
Steve Cohen, who would you like to see the Democrats face? And following up from what Jeremy Gez said earlier, who would you see as the candidate that could energize the Democrats in 2 years' time?
Well, I'd certainly not like to see Donald Trump be a candidate again, because I wouldn't want to see him get near the presidency. I really think he belongs in prison, and he may end up there. He's committed enough crimes. But so I wouldn't want, he'd be the easiest person to beat, but I'd hate for him to have the nomination and have some fluke that he could win. As far beyond Trump, I don't know who would be somebody I'd want to see run on the Republican side who we could defeat. And on the Democratic side, I'm not going to be foolish enough to say that I'm for anybody but Joe Biden.
When you heard Jeremy say that the Democrats have a harder time defining what they're about, how would you encapsulate? What are the Democrats about? And do you agree with him that that message is not getting through forcefully enough right now?
Well, I'm not sure. I think we did pretty well. I mean, I think we're going to hold the Senate, and that was a good thing. And I think that the House was so much closer. And if it weren't for the redistricting, I mean, Tennessee, they took a seat out of Nashville, which is one of the fastest growing cities in the nation. And they've always had their a representative to represent Nashville for over 100 years. And they took Nashville and divided it into three different districts where the rural suburban interest had by far the majority. So they created three Republican districts, which otherwise would have been one Democrat district. Well, that's one of their votes right there was done with redistricting, cutting it up. Democrats didn't lose there. The redistricting did it. And that happened in other places, too. I think overall we did pretty good. We just had a caucus call with Nancy Pelosi and Sean Patrick Maloney and the caucus, but they did most of the speaking. We think we did a good job this year. And normally the party out of power loses anywhere from 13 to 40 or 60 seats. We didn't lose but about six or seven or whatever it'll be. So we did defeated all of the historical standards and did quite well. I think the Democrats know what they're for. I have to disagree with the professor. We're for giving the working person a chance for fair taxation. We're for climate, dealing with climate change and having progressive perspective on saving the planet and getting back into the climate treaty. We're for civil rights. We're for voting rights. We're for women's rights. We're for women having the choice if they choose to have make the decision on whether or not to have an abortion, their own health care. But we are for, we know where we're at, and we're for the working person. We're for putting people over politics. And we've done that too much. In some cases, I think it's the right thing to do, but sometimes we're not as tough as the Republicans are in campaigns. The Republicans stress crime, and so maybe five or six Democratic congresspeople talked about defund the police, what's called the squad. Most all the other Democratic congresspeople were not for defunding the police in any way whatsoever and funded the police through the rescue bill, and many cities took advantage of that and hired more policemen. But they harped on that, and they were good on messaging, and they said, oh, the Democrats are for defunding the police. And that seemed to be effective. The problem with inflation and with the price of gasoline, that's a worldwide problem. America's inflation rate is not as high as most of the countries in Europe. And then the price of gasoline has gone up because of the Ukraine war and because of Russia. And they're getting close to Saudi Arabia and how they raised the oil prices most recently. And this was Putin. So President Biden has done everything he can to work with the Saudis, went down and humbled himself to talk with them, and yet they went with the Russians. This was not his fault. It's not the Democrats' fault, and inflation is not, it's not Joe Biden's fault. And we tried, we passed a bill to dealing with getting more chip production in this country. That was a major bill. We had lots of infrastructure bills that were bipartisan and others that were bipartisan. So I think the Democrats know where we're at, and I think we've messaged it pretty well, but we need to get away from letting the squad and some quote-unquote, they're not progressive because I'm progressive. They are, some of them consider themselves socialists. They proudly call themselves socialists. They should not be leading the on the Democratic message, and the press sometimes lets them do that.
Well, let's look at the top two issues that energize voters, according to an NBC News poll. Inflation coming in number one. You mentioned it's Congressman, 31% of them. And you can see that those who were concerned about inflation, well, they overwhelmingly voted Republican. Abortion coming in number two. And that abortion, 27%, those worried about that, well, they broke even more for the Democrats instead. COVID, these issues of inflation and abortion eclipsing the likes of crime, gun policy, and immigration. Annick Cizel, a lot of the issues are not down to who was elected or not elected on Tuesday night, but down to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Actually, yes. I was surprised when the Supreme Court decided to tackle Roe v. Wade before the elections. I mean, it was a bargain. It was just playing poker. It could have played in the hands of red states that most definitely re-elected governors and are building up the policy, the anti-abortion policy, built it up into the basis for these elections. But on the other hand, it polarized blue states' independence. It polarized a lot of independents who were not necessarily going to side with the Democrats, but did vote Democratic in order to keep abortion legal in some way in their state. So it was really, they played a hand which was risky. And I don't know.
You feel like it's backfired?
I it's maybe a little too early to tell. At least I don't know well enough what polls were taken as people had just voted. We'll know in days to come to what extent it backfired, but that's the feeling, at least, that I'm getting right now.
Melissa Hart, there were referendums on abortion in five states. In all of them, abortion rights were upheld, including the likes of conservative Kentucky. Do you agree with Annick Cizel that the Supreme Court decision did not help Republicans in this election cycle?
Oh, I think it hurt them a great deal because not only was it just completely fumbled the messaging on what actually happened when the Supreme Court, all it did was say that there's no federal right to abortion under the federal constitution. So basically it kicked it back to the states. But the Democrats used that issue and they spun it to make it sound as if the Republicans were taking people's their freedoms away, that they were going to, you know, stop abortions in all the states. And the messaging was very effective and it scared a significant proportion of the electorate, obviously, to have catapulted that issue, which really hasn't been much of an issue.
But there are many states where you can't. There are many states where you can no longer get an abortion now, and you have to travel out of state if you've got the money to go have one.
Again, it kicked the issue back to the states. That was what I said. I'm not arguing with that point. I'm saying that it kicked it back to the states, meaning that it should have affected your U.S. congressional elections at all, because it's not a federal issue anymore. So that was interesting to me, that the really how uninformed the public is and how federalism, which is our federal government, doesn't deal with every issue, that the issues that the federal government doesn't deal with are the purview of the states. And so that being the case, it should have been a big issue in state elections. It turned out to be a bigger issue, it looked like, for some of those congressional elections. I saw all kinds of ads like Fetterman. That was what he talked about. The guy just won a U.S. Senate seat and he'll have nothing to say about it. So it's very interesting how uninformed a lot of the voters were and how poor the Republican messaging was post Supreme Court decision. Now, obviously, when that decision was made by the Supreme Court, it was not helpful to the Republicans running. It certainly gave the Democrats an opportunity to use that as a wedge issue, and they used it effectively.
Steve Cohen?
Yes, I'd like to interject. I have to disagree with Ms. Hart almost entirely on that. What the Supreme Court did in saying Roe v. Wade was not the law said that it goes to the states, but it didn't say it goes to the states. It still could be a federal issue. And Lindsey Graham introduced a bill on what the federal abortion law should be federally. And the Republicans have made it clear that they would come forth and have a national anti-abortion law passed, and that could be done. It's just a matter of the federal government doing it or not doing it. And they were going to do that, and they've done everything they can to limit abortion, and they were going to try to outlaw it. And after abortion comes gay rights, comes gay marriage, All those issues were there, and Clarence Thomas said it in his opinion that those issues concerning miscegenation laws and gay marriage were also issues similar with how they ruled on abortion that the court should take up. So there was a lot of concern, and there should be concern. Ms. Hart, I know, was elected, and she was a pro-life member of Congress, so she has a perspective. But the fact is, for her to say people were misinformed, they weren't misinformed. Republican sights of stopping anybody in this country from getting an abortion, and they were going to do it.
We're also taking a look at the issue of what will happen on foreign policy. I want to get to that in a minute. But first, let's get a live update. We're watching lots of tight races. Let's cross to Tucson, Arizona, where we can find France 24's Wassim Cornet, one of those three U.S. Senate seats that hangs in the balance is where you are. Now, 24 hours ago, when we were sitting in these very premises, we were wondering, Wassim, what would the vote count be like? Arizona was one of those places where it was tight back in 2020. Would there be a so-called election deniers? Would there be tension? What has it been like?
Well, Francois.
Oh, we seem to be having an issue, Wasim, with the audio. We'll try to reconnect with you a little bit later on in the program. The next Republican Speaker of the House insists, by the way, when it comes to the issue of whether or not there'll be gridlock, that he's ready to compromise to get bills passed.
Republicans will work with anyone who's willing to join us to deliver this new direction that Americans have demanded. But there's no time to waste. Our work begins now. Let's get America back on track.
With McCarthy wondering aloud recently, though, about whether to tighten the purse strings on U.S. support for Ukraine, that country's president issued an Election Day appeal on Tuesday directly to U.S. voters.
I call on you to maintain unwavering unity as it is now until that very day when we all hear those important words we have been dreaming of, until we hear that peace has finally been restored. Democracies must not stop on their way to the victory.
Jeremy Gesby, we hear Volodymyr Zelensky a lot. Hearing him speaking English is not so much. What was your reaction when you heard that?
It's interesting because he's really good at doing this. He does this with the U.S. public. He gave that vibrant speech to the Knesset in Israel. He has that ability. And he knows, I think, fully well, and he's well advised, that in the United States, I think, there is a internal debate, and it pays off and gives you a lot of political mileage to say, no more blank checks, a little bit what Kevin McCarthy actually said. It's fairly easy because you basically address the middle class that has paid a particularly high tribute in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's a way to basically say, we're basically protecting the little guy. We're not sending the boys abroad anymore. That being said, I think he's also facing a major, major risk, is that structurally speaking, I think the U.S. will always support Ukraine, but they may not share, the two countries may not share the same goals. For the United States, Ukraine is a strategic interest. It's not a vital interest. Strategic interest means if we can weaken, the U.S. can weaken Russia, indirectly China, discredit Iran, whose role has been crystal clear in Ukraine with the drones, then that's all good. But if Zelensky is going to say, we need to take back Donbass and Crimea, that's where I think the buck stops in Washington, probably because Washington doesn't share that goal, and probably Washington won't want to go that far.
You agree with that, Anik Cizan?
I do agree with that, and also with the fact that it's all a question of how long this war is supposed to last. And if it is supposed to last until Crimea and Donbass are freed from Russia, it's going to outweigh what the United States can pay for, can actually send across the Atlantic, not just in terms of military assistance, which I'm pretty sure a lot of Republican newcomers and the Republicans who in the Senate were already there. I'm pretty sure most of the Republicans, maybe not all of them, but most of them will support military assistance to Ukraine. Where the buck is going to stop is on humanitarian assistance, is on logistics, is on making Ukraine more accountable to what land lease means. Because this Land Lease Act of 2022, this revival of the World War II 1941 Land Lease Act for the defense of democracy in Ukraine, is land lease. It's not just grants to Ukraine. There's going to be, I wouldn't be surprised if there were more inquiries within the Senate Foreign Relations, House Foreign Affairs Committees, more inquiries as to what is the end game for U.S. assistance in Ukraine, and more examination.
Is that
of
a good thing?
Well, after all, it's part of the law. I mean, it's part of the legislation. It's a Land Lease Act. But also, once peace is back in Ukraine, hopefully the sooner the better now, once peace is back in Ukraine, I would expect a consensus, actually, a bipartisan consensus on the other side of land lease, the end game of land lease, meaning what Ukraine is going to give back to to the United States. Paying back financially is out of the question. But what is in the bargain, I don't know. Military bases, construction work, reconstructing Ukraine. There must be another side to land lease from what we are being told on an everyday basis, meaning the billions of dollars that are flowing into Ukraine right now.
Steve Cohen, you agree?
Well, I don't know if I agree totally or not. I'm a big supporter of Ukraine and President Zelensky. I was in a meeting in Warsaw at the Security Forum. We had a dinner with Ambassador Brzezinski, and General Petraeus was leading a discussion. They were talking about what were the biggest factors going to affect the Ukraine war in the next few months. And everybody talked about the southern attacks and the eastern frontier and Crimea and you name it. And I told them, I said, the biggest thing's going to be the November elections. And the Republicans have said, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who unfortunately has a much stronger position in their party, that they will not give any more money to Ukraine.
Yeah, but isn't she an outlier?
Well, who knows? I mean, Kevin McCarthy's got a very slim group. He's gonna have to make alliances with those people. And he's put her front and center. When he announced his policies, she was right behind him in the stage. Chuck Grassley, an octogenarian who's had five terms in the Senate, had her go out to lead a rally for him. So she's getting a prominent place, even though she's an outlier. The Republicans don't consider that, and among their base, she isn't. I mean, Ms. Hart was in the Congress before I got to the Congress. And you asked me who I'd like to see as Republican nominee. The people I would like to see who could do a good job are the Margaret Chase Smiths, the Chuck Percys, the Bill Scrantons, the Nelson Rockefellers. They don't exist anymore. The Republican Party does not have those type of people. When they do, Rob Portman, who I was a big fan of, and they didn't have the wherewithal to stand up to Trump. A few of them did. Most of them who did got beat in their primaries or decided not to run because of the vitriol against them in the House, people like Katko and Anthony Gonzalez, who were outstanding members. There's not much left in the House of that type of leadership. Ken Zinger and Cheney, they had strong leadership, but they had not to run, be defeated or not run.
Melissa Hart, we're speaking at a time when we never thought we'd be back to war in Europe, that there are even nuclear threats from the Russian president. We thought that was over with 3 decades ago. How do you see the Republican Party standing on Ukraine in the next 2 years?
Yeah, just a couple things about the Republican Party. It's fun to hear an analysis from a sitting Democrat congressman saying that there are no moderates in the Republican Party. When there are no real moderates in the Democratic Party, Abigail Spanberger, who is a moderate from Virginia, just barely hung on to her seat. So it is clear that both parties have been electing people who are farther from the center. I think that's a bad thing. I think maybe that's one thing that he and I might agree on today. But when it goes to unlimited support for foreign governments, for wars that they're in, even ones that are from encroachment from a dangerous neighbor, we saw what the Obama administration was willing to do when Putin invaded Ukraine in, 2014? And the answer was little to nothing. And so the question now is, are we going to blame the Republicans if this very generous support for Ukraine under the Biden administration doesn't continue forever? Because we really don't know what the end game is here. And I think it's important for the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress and the president to discuss that with the American people, and they aren't doing that. We need, as the American public, to understand exactly what the goal is. I lived through the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq in order to push back and the Taliban in order to deal with Al-Qaeda, and look what happened. So it's important for the United States to remember what we are, what is our mission there, and not just remember it, identify it. It's important for us to assist our European allies. It's important that Ukraine figure out whether it is going to be a part of Europe or whether it is going to be settling back into being a satellite, because their free and fair elections were not so free and fair, and it was hard to determine really what direction they were going in before this even happened.
I'm sorry, are you saying the Ukrainian election was not free and fair?
The Ukrainian elections, we saw the Orange Revolution, we saw them go back and forth with their leadership, and it really was unclear whether they wanted to really move in a direction of Western Europe. So you know, Zelensky is convenient now, conveniently a friend of the United States because we can help him. The question is, where do they want to go? And the other, I think, even more important question is, what is the strategic, right? What is our interest and what are we willing to do? And it needs to be discussed with the American people before we engage in a proxy war with Russia, which is what this is right now.
All right. Russia, which invaded Ukraine back in February, he has chased the gremlins. So we can cross back now to Wassim Cornet in Tucson, Arizona, where it's one of those three crucial Senate races that will decide the balance in the upper chamber up for grabs. I was asking you earlier, Wassim, whether it's tense like it was in 2020.
It was tense, and it is still tense, and it will likely continue to be a very tight race for the foreseeable future, right up until we get 100% of those votes and ballots counted. Let's talk about those numbers. As the first batches of results came through throughout the evening yesterday evening, as was expected, they generally tended to favor Democratic candidates, whether it was at the governor's level or the senator's level or the secretary of state level. Those Democratic candidates, were holding a commanding lead. As the evening progressed, however, although we did hear Senator Mark Kelly speaking at the watch party we attended yesterday that he was confident and things were looking good, well, as the evening progressed and we got more and more a day of ballots counted, well, that lead dwindled because we do know, of course, that Republican voters tend to prefer to vote in person and on Election Day. So here's where things get a little bit technical. There are several counties, of course, reporting results across the state of Arizona. Many of them, most of them, do not report directly to the Secretary of State and give those numbers of how many outstanding ballots there are left. It is highly encouraged, but Arizona state law does not require these counties to report those numbers as they continue counting. The only county that does that right now is Maricopa County, and that is a big one because it is home to Phoenix. It is home to two-thirds of Arizona voters. And so they stopped counting at about 2 a.m. last night. They issued one final update at that time and said, we have counted all of the votes that were submitted on Election Day. And again, going back to what I said a minute ago, those tend to heavily favor Republicans. So what is left to count today? Well, of course, we're still expecting to hear from different counties, more rural counties, more urban counties, like here, Pima County, where Tucson is located. But again, we are also hearing, expected to get more of those ballots that were submitted early but dropped off yesterday. And so those will be the numbers that we will be keeping an eye on. And Maricopa County, again, where two-thirds of Arizona voters are located, said that they would release another big batch of numbers tonight, and hopefully by then we'll have a clearer picture of how these critical races are playing out.
It's going to play out until the month of December. Steve Cohen, one final word on this, because here in Europe we were worried after the January 6th, the storming of the U.S. Capitol, how much tension would there be around these elections, election deniers in parts. Right now, are your fears assuaged when you see how things are going so far on the day after the midterms?
They are, as far as this election goes, although we'll have to see how the results come out. There are any problems with the vote count. But the concern is still the change in laws that have given more power to the secretaries of states or the governors to determine how the electoral votes will be cast in 2024. And some states pass laws like that, and that's concerning. But this election seemed to be fine. There were not intimidations or problems with Proud Boys or Oath Keepers or whatever. And I think it was a fair, free election.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. We'll, of course, keep watching those election returns. I want to thank you, Congressman Steve Cohen. Again, congratulations on your re-election in Tennessee. I want to thank former Congresswoman Melissa Hart for joining us from Pittsburgh, Annick Cizel, Jeremy Ghez. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.